Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com, and on this Dave's Got Guests segment, I'm pretty thrilled. We've had some famous people on this program and some not so famous people and one or two infamous people. I guess this fellow falls into the category of all three, which is kind of interesting, and we'll discuss the various permutations of that, but this is exciting for a lot of reasons. I mean, I was a little bit late getting into the whole post-punk new wave scene and all that represented. I mean, I had some friends who were in it a bit before I was, and they were bringing home the first Pretenders album or the early Stiffs label music, people like Elvis Costello or Nick Lowe or the great Ian Dury, and another person whom I kind of liked instantly when I first heard his songs, because although they were new wave and the voice was certainly a little different from the normal pop slick radio voice, the songs had this very catchy, kind of old style, real fun and hummable craft to them. And this fellow's name, I don't think anybody even knew his last name in those years. He was just known by the nickname Reckless Eric. So we're going to get into where that nickname came from and where he's come from in the past, 30 years since those times. So I want to welcome to the States and to the studio, Reckless Eric Goulden. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
How are you doing? Welcome here.
Yeah.
What do you think of Babylon, Long Island so far? You don't seem terribly impressed.
Well, no, I'm not unimpressed. I'm thrilled to bits. I got a train here from New York, from Penn Station.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terribly unimpressed with the transport system here. I mean, it works, but I'm just as a visitor.
Yeah.
I just spend my time terrified. I call it humiliation time.
Because of the conductors or the ticket takers.
Everything you have to. I don't know how do New Yorkers or Americans learn. Learn the transport system. Am I born with the information? Do you come equipped with genes that carry all the information? Because first thing, I don't know where to get a ticket, so I go to the box and there's a man or a woman sitting in the box with a big microphone, and I go, excuse me, you know, because I'm English and we're very polite and all that, and I'd like to buy a ticket to go to, because in England you always give the destination, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to buy a ticket to go to such and such, and they look at me and I go like that into the microphone. I don't know what the hell they're saying, you know.
Yeah.
It's humiliating.
Mm.
And then of course you haven't got the right. You know, the right ticket or the ticket, the thing that you slide through, the sliding thing, you do it the wrong way and everyone behind you goes, well, it doesn't take much to put a Metro card into the machine, you know. And
yeah, meanwhile, every single one of them has had the same problem at some point with a Metro card where the strip is worn down and they put it the wrong way.
Yeah.
They're just angry because they're late.
Mm. So everybody's screaming at you by this time, you
yeah.
know. It's got better. I've learnt that business, but of course I get into Penn Station, I can't find where to buy a ticket.
Right. Well, there's electronic booths, and they've got the real humans.
So
did you go to the humans?
No, I couldn't find any human, but I asked a human woman, but I think she thought I meant something else. But she was...
You wanted to put your ticket in her slot.
The person who was standing still, you know. And, yeah, I asked a man wearing some sort of official-looking badge, but he didn't know either.
Hmm.
You know, but I found it eventually.
Good.
I found it. I got him. It's...
I have to say, my memories of the tube, or, you know, the English system, it was very, very well laid out, but you would figure, you know, you would get off one escalator or place, and then it would look like you'd just go over to get the other connecting train, and it would actually be half a mile away underground.
Oh,
it was
yeah,
just this endless trek.
Sometimes it's quicker not to change trains. It's actually quicker just to get out at Green Park and walk to Piccadilly or whatever it is, rather than change trains to take the one stop.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And it's probably cheaper as well, because it costs a different amount to every different station. I don't know how they work that out.
Yeah, actually, the one thing about the subways is still, it's one fare all the way. Unlike the Long Island Railroad, you really can go to, like, Far Rockaway on the subway for $2.
Oh, I went to Coney Island. I went with my girlfriend on Sunday. We went to Coney Island.
Cool.
Have you been there?
Not since I was a child.
We went on the big wheel, you know. She said, look, you've got to go on the big wheel. It's Coney Island. And then we get there, and I'm looking, and it looks a bit high, you know, and I don't want to say, I've never actually been on a big wheel before. I'm a bit nervous, you know. I said, right, okay, yeah, I'm up for it, yeah. we could take a static carriage, or we could take one of the swinging ones. And I'm sort of like, what do you mean a swinging one? She said, well, it kind of slides. And I'm thinking, I don't want to know about this. And so you can see all these wimpy looking people, not many people, queuing up to get in the static carriages. And then there's all these sort of hard nuts, and they're getting asked, do you want to go swinging or static? And they're going, swinging. You know, and I'm thinking, and we're standing there in the swinging queue, and we're the most soft-looking people in it, and we're both starting to get nervous. So, but we get in it, and it's like a metal cage, you know, and you get clamped into it, locked in it, and I think, how are we going to get out of this? You know, what if they don't want to let us out? So that's all a bit nerve-wracking, and then the thing goes up, and you're thinking, this is very nice, here it goes, nothing to it really, lovely view. Get to the top, you're on top of the world there, looking down all over Coney Island. Suddenly it lurches over, and the whole car slides. It sort of plummets into space.
Wait, this isn't a Ferris wheel.
Yes, it is. But this thing is on a sliding contraption, so suddenly the whole of the world drops beneath you, and you're plummeting, you're free-falling over Coney Island in a red metal cage with a seat in it.
And remember, this is fun. This is Americans' idea of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
was this fun for you?
It was terrifying.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And of course, you know, I don't want to look like a pussy in front of my girlfriend, do I, you know?
Yeah, no, like a cat, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like some, you know... Well, so, like, I'm trying, we're both terrified, you know. So it starts to get, eventually it starts to go down, and
if you've ever gone down with a push, I'm not even going to go there,
So it goes down, and I'm thinking, this is fine, right, okay, well, glad that's over. I managed to, it doesn't stop. Gets to the bottom and it carries on, and I think, oh no, we're going up again, we've got to go through this whole damn thing again, which we did, and it was, I thought, it can't be as bad the second time, and it was worse.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I think it's because I knew what was happening. So we get out of that one, and like...
And then you had three frankfurters in a shake or something.
No, not at all, no, I had to walk around a bit to get over that, and...
Yeah, that's like I was in Disneyland... About 8 or 9 years ago, when I had a play done out in California.
Yeah.
And, like, the cast, they were all young people, and they go to Disneyland all the time, and I'd never been. And, you know, I went to be with them and to see it, because I hadn't been to Disney World, hadn't seen it. And for them, it was about the ride. So you would stand there for about 45 minutes in blazing sun to go on one ride, which was about 2.5 minutes long, and unpleasant... I'm a wuss, like you, and, I didn't get sick or anything, but I'm like, this is not fun for me, this is hell, I'm in hell.
Yeah, well...
All day long.
The Coney Island experience, right, it gets worse. I mean, we did some other things, we went to the Freak Show, and that was fun.
Oh, that, is that already on?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, open this weekend, and then we went on a ghost train that was good. And I could take that, I could handle that, you know, I wasn't scared at all.
Good.
Yeah.
By the way, was Todd Robbins at the Freak Show? He's like the carny guy. Was he part of that? He was on the show, and he had an off-Broadway show about a year and a half ago. Todd, tall guy, hammers stuff on his nose, but you may have seen a different nose hammer.
No, I didn't see a nose hammer. They didn't have a nose hammer.
Oh, no.
They had a man called Eek, who's incredibly tattooed, who lies on a bed of nails and then gets two men out of the audience to stand on an upturned bed of nails that's on top of him. And I don't know how he came out of that alone, actually.
I guess it's fun.
they had the sword swallower. That was the only thing I couldn't watch.
Oh, yeah.
I'm painting myself as a bit of a wimp here.
Well, no, I don't mind. Maybe that's a latent gay thing, God forbid. But I don't mind the sword swallower, you know, even when he comes up to you and kneels. But the.
Well, it was a nice girl who was doing it, but I couldn't imagine, you know, how she was.
Oh, it was a girl. Oh, actually, yeah. I could watch it, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she was very sexy and all the rest of it. But,
was the bearded girl there? She's been around a lot.
No, there was a girl with a tattooed face. Oh. And I thought, she looked very pretty and everything. I thought, when she gets to about 65, what's it going to be like then?
Oh, and it's basically going to be like the map of the tube in London, pretty much. So you just look at her and it's like, that's where that's going. That's Hampstead.
I think it might be the subway in somewhere like Oslo, actually.
But, oh my gosh.
So the Coney Island experience, I'm determined to finish this, because it got worse.
How do you get worse than that?
Well,
I mean, the freak show sounds good, but
you know
it's right.
Freak, what's it called? Switchback roller coaster.
Oh. Well, why did you go on?
Well, my girlfriend, Kelly, she says, look, we're in Coney Island, we've got to go on it. I went on it once, it's great, we've got to go on it, and I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, and she says, it's made of wood, and I'm thinking, I don't want to go on it even more than I didn't want to go on it before. Now it's made of wood, you know. And I remember a friend of mine who lives in Atlanta sort of mentioning it to me, because it's well famous, and saying, probably the people that maintain it are not qualified to do so. I mean, I'm sure that's not true, but all these things go through your head.
Yeah.
You know?
And one out of every 10,000 people
I'll tell you what, I'll have a look at it. So we look at it, and we see the thing hurtling around all over the place with the people in it, and they've all got their arms in the air doing some sort of Mexican wave and having a great time. And I thought, well, they're all doing it, and they're having a great time. I should be all right. So we go. Again, there's not a queue.
Really?
There was a lot of people on Coney Island in Coney Island at the time, but there was not a queue for this attraction.
Oh.
So, like, there's a line on the wall. It says, if you're below this height, you can't go on the ride. And I'm trying to get down. So we get two tickets. We get there, and like, I'm shuffling us back in the queue, so we won't be in the front because I don't want to see. So we get into one of these cars, and it's in the car in front. There was an enormously fat man, right. Which
good cushioning, you know.
Well, it made it worse because the thing set off, and I thought, this is it. I know this is a bad idea. I just know it. And it sets off, and it goes round a curve, and it starts to gather speed, and then it started to go uphill.
Yeah.
And it went up until it was vertical. So I'm kind of like lying on my back with my feet in the air, as it were.
Well, that can be fun, but yeah.
Yeah, well, not in this case. Well, this fat bloke sort of bounced, you know, in front of me. I'm thinking, this defies gravity.
This
thing is going up. And I'm thinking, if it's going up like this, it's going to have to come down. So we get to the top of it, and it suddenly, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm glad that's over. Just for a split second, it was fine. Nice view and everything. And then it went, turned round, and it just plummeted. It was free-falling through space. And it was like all my bones and bits of me were all going down in the wrong order and everything. And I'd left half of me back up there. And everyone's screaming, and suddenly I'm screaming as well, you know. And it was undignified. It was terrible. And it's getting buffeted about. And it got to the bottom of this thing, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. Oh, I'm still alive. Oh, I'm going to be a nicer person. And it just and it went up again. Yeah, it did the whole routine again, and it got worse every time it did it, and it buffeted you about, and you couldn't get out or anything. It's the worst thing. We got out. I was white.
Yeah.
People were asking me if I was all right. I was trembling. You were really, I could hardly walk. But I've all been reassembled in the wrong order anyway. I can hardly walk. I'm like, are you all right? I'm going, I've been in car crashes that were more fun.
Oh, my. I heard your girlfriend like it.
Well,
she loved it, right?
She wants to go again next week.
I knew it. Oh, okay. And will you, or are you going to put your shaky foot down and say no?
I don't know what I can do about that.
You do what all men do. You think of something else that's equally cool but not as scary. Divert her.
Diversionary tactics.
Museums are great. They're like a children's science museum. You know, cool things to do, but no pain.
Yeah. 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 Anything but that. Anything but that.
Well. By the way, we're talking with Reckless Eric here, case you were wondering. I don't know how we got on that tangent, but I'm glad we did. And I'm glad you're enjoying... how long are you in America for? I mean, don't live here. You live.
No. But I've been coming here a lot because my girlfriend lives here, and she's American, but she's coming over to live in England, so...
Oh, what does she do, by the way? Oh,
she's a licensed veterinary technician.
Oh...
Yeah,
we have two dogs at home, so... Yeah.
All right, she'd know what to do with them.
She would or she wouldn't?
She would.
Oh,
yes,
okay,
so
good,
Yeah, it's another world.
Do you have pets? Does she have pets, or...
Cats.
Oh, sounds like her thing. Or are they yours also?
Oh, a lot of cats, yeah. We're covered in cat hair, though. No, they're great. I like cats.
And we're back to the pussy jokes. But no, I will not. I will refrain.
Pussy jokes, yeah.
So how'd you meet her, by the way?
I knew her ex-husband.
Oh, okay. And now No.
So like that, really.
All right, let's backtrack. Let's really go back and talk the talk that you've had to talk for I guess the past 30 years now.
I tried to. I divert you into this other, and we end up talking some other rubbish because I'm so. Sick of talking about the normal rub. I'm not actually.
Okay. Because I'm a stubborn little Jew, and I will eventually get back to the important. Well, no. I mean, Coney Island is important too, but we also want to give people context as to. I'm sure they know who you are, but even if they don't, or they just want to remember along with you.
But a load of people have probably turned off. They're going, we don't want to hear some limey whatever talking about Coney Island.
Oh, I'm sure they're fine with you talking about it. If you start talking politics and dissing America and Bush, then, by all means, but then we'll lose probably half our audience.
Oh, right, okay, well...
But feel free, you know.
I won't do that yet.
Yet, okay, I'll hold you to that.
Yeah, maybe that will be a good closing down program. Do you have closed down? They used to have it in England before the telly started running, the radio and everything started running all night. They used to have closed down and they used to play God Save the Queen.
We would have sermonette. I remember this from my childhood. It was like a little 5-minute, a priest or usually a priest, occasionally a rabbi. They'd throw us a sop now and then. Would give us a little short, semi-religious, but not too like, Jesus-y speech. Then they would have the flag waving and play the Star Spangled Banner, and then either you would hear and just see snow on the speckled snow, or if it was a more advanced television station, you would see color bars and.
So they should bring all that back. I used to have one on Southern TV in the 80s that was. A program that I put on late at night before they shut down, it was called Company, and it was 10 minutes, and it seemed to be taking place in someone's kitchen, and it had a sort of scrub pine table, and round it there was a nun in sort of like, you know, nun's gear, but casual nun's gear.
Right.
Not just with the headdress and a frock on or something.
And, a wimple and a bra. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And a rabbi in an old pullover. And then there was a vicar who was young and trendy who just alluded to the fact that he played in a band every so often. And various other kind of normal-looking people, and they used to sit round a table, and they'd all be cradling these cups of mugs of Maxwell House coffee and that, and talking about stuff, you know, as I mean, it sounds like a joke, doesn't it, really?
No.
A rocking vicar, a nun, and a rabbi sat round the table.
You know, it would sound like a joke, but there's actually a very popular program on sort of public access here that involves a rabbi and a priest.
This was my favorite program. It was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it would come on, and they would be in the middle of it, and they wouldn't notice that the viewers had joined. And then one of them would say, oh, yeah, we were talking about how God is omnipresent in the supermarket, and I was just saying I was coming back from a gig the other night, and, you know, the vicar and that, and they would talk about stuff for about 10 minutes, very soothing, and completely ridiculous, but they don't have that anymore.
No, well, because it's 24/7 everything.
Bad American made-for-TV films.
Well, yeah.
I'm an expert on them.
Okay, which is the best worst?
Oh, I can't tell you.
The one with the most nudity, of course, obviously.
They just mould together, they go into one.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think they just cut the stuff off in strips, actually.
And they all star Michael Pear, for some reason, or who else do they? Well, anywho. How did we get on that? Okay.
Oh, dear, we can't get on to the right subjects, can we?
Well, there's no wrong subject on Dave's Gone By, especially when we're talking with Reckless Eric Goulding. I'm going to hold you to that question, Ben.
I either go either on under Eric Goulding or Reckless Eric.
I don't put
the two names together.
Okay, well, where did the Reckless tag come from?
Right, well, it was 1976. I just made my first record for Stiff Records. And everybody was operating under pseudonyms because everybody who was involved with Stiff Records was signing on, which means claiming benefit or welfare, as you call it over here. The dole.
Oh, you were on the dole while still... Okay, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It was how it all worked.
Ah.
You know, it's terribly funny that now our Prime Minister is very proud of Britain's third largest export is rock music or whatever. It's one of the biggest industries that the country has, and it's built on benefit fraud.
Well, at least that segment of it, you know, yeah.
So everybody,
I love Cilla Black, was, you know, but
everybody had a name. Captain Sensible, Rat Scabies, Dave Vanium in the Damned.
Right, yes.
Elvis Costello, who was, for a while he was D.P. Costello, but of course his real name is Declan McManus.
Right.
Which means I've just blown his cover and the authorities are going to be into him for...
No, he put his name, that name on a couple of his labels. He's been changing, forever, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
In fact, Napoleon Dynamite was, again, one of those...
Yeah, but isn't that someone else? Isn't that a bad...
It is now.
Is it a bad made-for-TV film or something? I'm a bit...
I got it from the local library just last week to see it, because it got some good reviews. Halfway through, I was like, it's not funny, it's just strange. Which is a shame. It's about a high school kid. You're diverting the subject again, but it's about a high school kid who's an... ultra, ultra nerd, and not even a likable, lovable nerd, but a really nasty, geeky pencil neck nerd who's miserable to everybody, and everybody's miserable to him. And that's pretty much... he's got this brother who's also nerdy, and they all do nerdy, awful things.
Haven't most films all been made already?
Well, all films have all been made already. They just keep remaking them. But it's different. I will give it that. It's not quite like any teenage film you've ever seen. But that doesn't necessarily mean you want to see this one. Yeah.
Yeah. This is Reckless Eric on Dave's Gone By. So where were we?
We were in 1976.
76.
Right. How did you get from being little Eric Goulden to being a Stiff label artist?
I was an art student. I used to... Well, I well, I studied fine art, painting and sculpture for 4 years when I left school. I was at art college in Bristol in England, and then in Hull in the northeast of England. I used to play in bands. I went to art school because that's where everybody else went. John Lennon, Ray Davies.
Both of the Stones, I think.
Pete Townsend. I'm not sure. No, Mick Jagger didn't go to art school. He went to the London School of Economics.
Right.
Yes, it shows, doesn't it?
Well, they all got rich enough.
They all got rich enough, but Mick Jagger got richer than the others, yeah. But anyway,
yeah.
So obviously I had to go to art school because that's where you went. And I was quite into it all as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a degree and all that kind of thing, so...
I mean, we're discussing off the air Neil Innes, who had been on this program a few months ago.
Neil went to art school, yes, and I know Neil well.
And he still pursues it. And his wife does flower arranging, and I mean, they are still seriously into that aspect. Do you still do any physical arts?
No, not really. I mean, I do a lot of funny drawings, which I do with a computer program.
Oh.
I won't use anything sophisticated to do it. But, yes, I do that, I wanted to do music. So when I left art school, that was about 1976, and I'd been writing songs. I used to write, and that was an odd thing to do then. Like, if you came to write songs, if you came from the provinces and you played in a band, no one ever had original songs. Everybody did cover versions.
Even in... I mean, we're not talking about the original British Invasion here. We're talking about the past that. So I would assume writing songs...
Yeah.
You would have been influenced by Beatles and...
One of, like, professional bands that you might call professional who got a deal, a label, a manager and all the rest of it would have been... Obviously, they'd be writing songs, but... Little local groups never did, and I was in like little local groups, and we used to do Bo Diddley numbers and Chuck Berry numbers
and Skiffle and Lonnie Donegan.
No,
and
we didn't do. No, no,
oh, no.
I'm not that old.
It doesn't have to be that old. You know.
No, we used to do Small Faces numbers like Sha-la-la-la-lee and what else? Can't remember now.
Okay. What were some of the names of the groups that you were in back then? Do you remember?
I was in a great art school band called Addis and the Flip Tops.
Addis and the Flip Tops, or Addis and the Flip Tops?
Addis and the Flip Tops. Flip Tops, yes.
Cool. And that was that kind of music. Do you remember any of the other names of the bands you were in?
I was in a band called the Rubies, who were called Ruby and the Takeaways for a while. I was the bass player in a dreadful hard rock band for a while. I don't even want to talk about that. And I played in working men's club bands and stuff, which was hard because, like, you had to play what you were told to play.
And it was audience requests basically ruled the day.
No, it was just like you had to do 3 20-minute sets, and you got to play a lot of dreadful stuff.
So how did you break out of that into writing your own songs and being more...
I got tired of playing Chuck Berry songs really badly, because like, we could never play them any good anyway. We could never play anything very good. And I said, look, we might be rubbish, and like, if we had our own songs, they might be rubbish too, but at least we wouldn't be the same as everybody else. So yeah. I thought, well, I was the bass player, and like, and then I wanted to be the singer, and I thought, well, if it was my songs, they couldn't stop me. I knew I couldn't sing very well.
You have a distinctive...
I have got better.
She turned you into a newt. But you got, yes. Sorry, that's a
what's that?
Obscure reference. So, yeah.
An obscure reference.
Python, yeah, okay.
yes.
Yeah, sorry, so I take you off track there, but okay. So you started writing for yourself and to prove that you could, and singing yourself.
Well, yeah, I started writing these songs, and like, they got a bit better, I suppose, and... we're playing our own stuff. We started to get a lot better in this last band I was in at art school. time. And then everyone said, you shouldn't be up here, you should go to London. So I left art school and off I went down to London, where the streets were paved with musicians or whatever.
Right. I mean, it was legitimately a scene. Did you realize it at that point, that there was, quote-unquote, a scene?
No, there wasn't. Well, yeah, there was something in the air. Around 74, 75, we started to realize there was some kind of thing in the air. And it started to gather pace by 76. And when I got there and I saw the Clash, I saw the Clash on one of their first gigs, and they were supporting a band called the Kersal Flyers, who were like a pub rock band that got successful. The Clash were quite life changing because it was just so confrontational.
Right.
That was when Keith Levine was still in the Clash. They had three guitars.
What? There was a Jew in the Clash?
Keith Levine.
Well, I don't know. I'm just. But,
well, yeah, Mick Jones. He's Jewish.
Good heavens! Yay! Yay
there
for
go.
Didn't know that. Are you? I mean, you have semi Jewish name, but I wonder.
I don't know. My name is a bit Jewish, and sometimes I wave my hands around when I talk, but I don't.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's great. Send your hate mail to. Oh, actually, we should mention that. We'll get back to this, but tell everybody that you do have a really, really cool website where they can find out about you, about all your CDs and all the stuff you're doing.
I doubt if anyone can find out anything much from my website, but I think it is quite cool in a way. It's recklesseric.com.
Oh, sure. That's easy. And it's Reckless with a W.
Of course it is,
folks.
Yeah.
Well, you know, not everybody may remember.
But anyway, that's why I got the name Reckless Eric, because I was going to put this, we were putting this record out, which was called Whole Wide World, and I had to have a name, and I was just someone who was around the Stiff thing, and then I was probably going to make a record under another name after that, you know. I mean, I figured that it didn't matter what you called yourself, you know, you'd make a record under one name and then under another, and then it would be really throwaway, because that was part, I suppose, of that kind of part of the original punk ethos, was that, like, you'd make the music more disposable, more trashy. Because we're talking about, I don't know what it was like over here, but over there we were talking about a scene that encompassed, like, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Genesis and...
We had disco, man. I mean, that's what we had.
Disco's great, but disco was homemade in the first place. You know, I think disco is much maligned. Now everyone's turned the radio
off. Now it was maligned, and now people who hated it understand that there was... at its best, the same with every other kind of music, including rap to Hawaiian steel guitar. You know, there's one percentage that's cream that's really exceptional.
Yeah.
But there was just so much else, and was on every other radio station, that there had to be a backlash, because you couldn't listen to the radio without hearing 20 minutes of one beat, whistles, and that was the song. And that's why they would, you know, blow up LPs in the middle of Yankee Stadium saying death to disco. Anyway, but
yeah,
so that's what we were rebelling, and you had Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Yeah,
Genesis, Yes, Supertramp.
Oh God,
and all this stuff, and it was so high flown, it was so precious, it was also expensive. You know, big production kind of stuff. Emerson, Lake and Palmer with three trucks, and they showed a film of it once on the telly and on the television, and the trucks had like the letters ELP, one on each articulated truck, you know. I think it was a revolt against, because there we are. You left school, there was nothing you could do, like, it was getting difficult to get jobs in England. We had no future.
No future, right.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Sex Pistols and all that. Were they first, or were they...
The Pistols, I first heard about the Pistols, I think, in 75, and, like, that was all, because, like, I used to look quite a lot like Johnny Rotten, really. It was very surprising to see it. In the first place, someone said, "Yeah, have you seen this?" It was in the NME, the New Musical Express. Have you seen this bloke? Look, he looks like you.
Hmm.
And it was very odd. And like, they were doing a lot of the same songs as us. There was something in the air, because the same thing, we're doing this thing in Hull, and then in Manchester there was like the Buzzcocks and stuff, and they were doing the same kind of thing. Cheap guitars, cheap little amplifiers, really scratchy sound and everything. It's the same as what we were doing. And it was the same as what was happening in London. There was something in the air.
Now, I might as well ask you, and again, forgive me if this is the kind of question that you've been asked 4 million times, but if you've already answered it 4 million times, then 4 million and one won't hurt you, will it?
Oh.
But have to know, like some of the people that you either were on a bill with or knew or met, any memories of John Lydon or Sid Vicious or that group? I mean, personal.
No, I was terrified of them. I didn't go anywhere near them, you know. I mean, I was always an admirer of the Clash. And, Strummer liked my stuff, too.
So, did you have any kind of friendship with Joe Strummer or Mick Jones? Did
I've
you?
Always been mates with their road manager, who was a man called Johnny Green.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another potential Jewish person there, maybe. But
My man's real name's John Broad.
Oh, no.
No. I don't know. He's from Kent. He's got a mouthful of broken teeth, and he's built like a wardrobe.
Ah, definitely not Jewish. Okay.
I don't know.
But, okay, he's a good friend, has been a friend. Yeah,
and, like, you know, I mean, everybody, I think as you in that time, it's like everyone thinks that everybody was real big mates, and that I never saw anybody. I mean, like, I was out touring all the time, and I suppose they were as well.
Well, I thought maybe you might have all been on gigs at the same time or opening.
No, I mean, like, well, I worked a lot with Ian Dury.
Wow, okay.
When before Ian made the album New Boots and Panties that sort of, in 77, that sort of almost literally rocketed him to stardom or whatever it did, he was my drummer. So Ian played the drums with me, and he produced the B-side of my first single, which was a track called Semaphore Signals.
Semaphore Signals, great. I did not know that he was doing that. And then he, because as unlikely in a way as you would be, no offense, to have been a rock star kind of performer, Ian Dury even more so, from the way he spoke, this working class. You know.
Also, as a drummer, he said, always wanting to be a drummer, stupid when half your body don't work, which is right, you know, because he had polio, so he had one side of his body was underdeveloped. He had a leg iron, and he had a sort of withered arm. And so there was only his right arm and his right leg that worked. So the sound was always really very the drumming was very
kind
minimal. He used to do great things with his bass drum, and he used to work the hi-hat really well. But he had the hi-hat clamped shut, and he'd be playing these great rhythms on the hi-hat, and then his left leg was doing nothing. And he used to sort of lift his right arm up and kind of drop it onto the snare drum, and that was the snare. And then he had all these cymbals that he used to play funny bits on, but always the bass drum and the hi-hat.
Wow.
And his bass drum was great. And he was an absolute pig to work with. He used to shout at us all the time because, like, it was my group, but he was in charge.
Now, this is, you know, I
mean, he was great. I can say that with absolute love and everything.
Well, because he's dead, yeah.
Yeah, he's dead now, but he was a very, very good friend of mine. You know, I loved him to bits and not.
Because I had gotten the feeling, and it was one of the questions I was going to ask, that all the people in that stable. I had gotten the feeling, certainly over the years, that
it's more of a sty than a stable.
Yeah, exactly. That you weren't all very nice people then, but Ian Dury seemed like he might be the nicest.
No,
but
he was,
I guess,
the worst.
Not.
He was the most monstrous.
I think
he was the most obviously monstrous. I think the most monstrous really was probably Elvis Costello.
Well, that I figured
is this kind of very ambitious songwriting machine type monster personage. Ian hated him.
Well, was it professional jealousy or was Costello being a jerk?
I think it was a professional thing, really. But Ian didn't differentiate, really.
Well, how did you feel about Elvis? In those days, you know? Indifferent, really.
Oh, I was terribly impressed that he could sort of, like, you know, I mean, like, in the time it took most people to go to the toilet, he could write a song. I was terribly impressed that he could do that, but I wasn't really touched by a lot of what he did. His first album didn't really bother me. The second one kind of sounded exciting.
I mean, we have to, I mean, for folks at home who may not be into that music or, because we have a very, very wide audience. We're talking about two very important rock and roll albums here, This Year's Model and My Aim Is True. Actually, I reversed them, but yeah. So I mean, that's the thing. You were coming to it from a perspective, well, he was another mate from that stable, and I wasn't, meanwhile, the rest of the world now thinks.
I used to like The Damned. The Damned, you know, their first album was monumental. I think that was actually the first, if you like, punk album,
right,
to be released,
and that really made an impression.
It's really exciting. I don't know about anything else. I never really got off on much else that they'd done, but that's probably because I didn't have time to listen to it. But that first album was remarkable. It still is.
And when you started then getting into the whole, I will call it a scene at that point, when you were on Stiff Label and all these folks.
We went on tour, Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, Ian Dury, me, Larry Wallace,
right.
Dave Edmonds came with us and whatever. it was, and suddenly, like, I went from playing in kind of working men's clubs and like little bars and like in the hall at the art school up in Hull, to playing in front of like 1,000 or 1,500 people a night.
Wow.
I'm like finding it quite confusing. I think I had to do it. I had to learn how to do it in public.
Did success, such as it was, change you? I mean, did you physically feel yourself like, first you were playing in pubs, and then within a year, if the limousine was late, well, I thought it was a limousine kind of track.
It was none of that, but no, I think, like, suddenly, obviously, I could afford to, I had a drink problem anyway, really, although I didn't realise it was a problem at the time, but
did it start before even were signed? It was
absolutely, art schools were very hard drinking places in those days.
Why did you turn to that?
I think it accelerated, the problem accelerated, because suddenly I could afford to buy bottles of vodka and stuff like that, and I was around, you know, I mean, like, I was around people who took lots of things and drank lots of whatever, everything was going on. I mean, it was proper sex, drugs, rock and roll, alcohol kind of.
Yeah. I mean, the CD that I have, the old LP of Big Smash with that wonderful cover and stuff, but the one CD I've had of yours until today, thank you, is the Live Stiffs, which is all of you, again, on that tour, and you sound wrecked. You were wrecked, Eric.
I did actually have laryngitis. I got a flu during that tour. It didn't make it better, probably because I was completely run down from the kind of, from the abuse, really. It was not good, really. Got more sorted out. I mean, I was able to tour for a long time without getting ill, eventually. But
well, when, in other words, so those were the really huge, exciting years for that whole thing.
I got very famous very quick. It was too much too soon, really. You need time. It's not, there was a time, it was the beginning of another era in music. I think in the 70s, like, labels like Island Records, when they started, they would they would figure that they'd make an album, a first album with a band, and they would send them away to somewhere where they could get themselves together, and then they'd make an album. They wouldn't worry that it was going to lose money, and they would put them out on a bit of gentle touring to see how they got on and everything, and then they would make a second album and aim to break even, and then aim to make a profit with the third album.
That's actually much gently. First, I've heard say, put things in a nice way from the record company perspective, where they're really trying to put out the, you know, they're taking the risk, they're spending the money, and the likelihood, even without funny accounting, of breaking even on the first one or two is very unlikely. I mean, all you hear mostly artists say, oh, the record companies are awful, and they sign you to these horrible deals right from the start.
They probably are now. There were a few that cared, I think, in the 70s, and then it got to, we were getting to this point where everyone wanted an immediate success, and if it wasn't successful, they'd get another one and throw that one away. No.
Was Stiff's like that, or what happened with Stiff's?
Eventually, it stopped. It very quickly after that Stiff tour, after the classic first Stiff tour, the two partners split. Jake Riviera, who managed Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, he took them away, and Dave Robinson, who was the other half, managed Graham Parker and the Rumour, who weren't on Stiff, and he had. He had Ian Dury, and he had me, and he had the Damned. I could have gone with Jake, but somehow I made a, I don't know, one way or another.
Well, it isn't necessarily the wrong, it's just it's a different choice.
I don't know, Jake once said that maybe he should have taken me with him, and he regretted that he hadn't, because I didn't get treated very well. But I did say at the time, well, you know, don't feel bad, because I probably would have screwed it up anyway.
Because you were still a mess.
Yeah.
How did you stop being a mess?
Oh, that.
Or are you still?
No. I actually stopped drinking. I've been sober and everything for 19 and a half years.
May I wish you a mazel tov on that? That's American talk. Congratulations on that. Was it AA or what did you do?
Bit of AA and I can't imagine. I can't begin to explain. It take too long. I knew, I was 12 years of hard abuse, and I either had to die or change it.
And you did change it. I mean, were you near death, or...
Yeah, several times, yeah.
Man. And were you still writing and recording up to that point, or...?
I left Stiff Records. I made three, four albums altogether, I think, for Stiff. But Stiff changed into a different company almost, like, in 78, from the beginning of 78, Stiff started to turn into this other... kind of monster, like a real record company that expected instant results of its artists, and had funny accounting, and people. The thing is, when we started with Stiff, like the whole thing was like we were laughing at all the proper record companies.
How did you do? I mean, when you came through all that, and okay, not counting all the money that you probably, you know, pissed away on liquor. Was there funny money, or were you okay? I mean, were you making a decent or a great living?
No, not really. I was on £50 a week all through the Stiff thing, which you can't equate it to now. £50 a week would just get you through, really.
Barely, yeah.
I mean, it paid the rent and, then, of course, I got a bit of money from the PRS, which is an English society that collects radio revenue. And eventually the publishers, who was Zomba Music, they accounted to me, and I got more money than I could dream of having, which wasn't actually a lot of money, which I probably drank away and invested in, like, bands that, in between that... because the money came after I'd left Stiff, really. I mean, by the time that Stiff was doing bands like the Bell Stars and really Madness and all that, I couldn't relate to that. Not, I mean, it's all well in its place, you know, and it's okay, but...
The scene was over. That moment was
yeah,
gone.
Yeah, because what happened, suddenly Stiff became like, it became for a little while, for a short while, it was the grooviest record label in the world. And so everyone wanted to work for it. So, of course, all these people from other record labels came and started working for it. And they were the labels that we'd been laughing at. And suddenly, from being on the side of poking fun at these people and getting up their noses and screwing them one way or another, turning their world on its head, we were suddenly in their world.
Well, isn't that... With
you know,
every
and it
know,
was it was like you know
generational
won't
yeah.
get fooled again by the Who, which I think is the greatest record ever made, and at the end meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Right. And you look in the mirror and that boss sometimes is, turns out to be you. That's the yeah. So
I left that and I kind of spent time in the wilderness, if you like. I sort of wandered around trying to get a record deal and couldn't because everyone knew that I was a drunk. I don't know, but I was writing songs. I wrote some good stuff at the time, which I later recorded.
So there was never a question of giving up music entirely. I mean, you came
out
of it.
Was. At one point, I worked for a country singer from North Carolina called George Hamilton IV, and I was his sound engineer when he toured in England. He was very successful in England. He's probably not successful over here.
We have a different George Hamilton. He's like a guy who tans a lot and acts in movies.
Yeah, that one, yeah. No, George Hamilton IV, he had a hit in the 50s with a song called A Rose and a Babe Ruth.
Yeah, okay.
I worked for him. Did that and, moved out of London, moved down to Kent, and I moved to the Medway.
Okay.
The Medway is Chatham, Medway, what they call the Medway Delta, Chatham, Gillingham, Rochester, it's where Wild Billy Childish comes from. That, there's a whole garage scene there.
Oh.
And, I suppose that saved my life. No, it didn't save my life, actually. It probably put me back creatively years, because eventually I got involved in that. But before that, I was with a label called Go Disc, Billy
okay.
Bragg and all that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
House Martins and everything. And I made an album for them, but we didn't get on, really. Could never take the continuing hypocrisy. They're supporting the miners' strike and saying that everybody is, you know, we're a socialist record label, but they're walking around in Armani suits.
Well, if everyone has an Armani suit, that's socialism.
Cool, yeah.
If all of them have the same pair of shoes, then, you know, they're all making it to the Ben and Jerry's quote, you know.
I got caught reading The Sun, which is one of those English newspapers that's fairly right-wing.
Yeah.
And I got caught reading it and was told I mustn't read it. And so I'm too old for people to tell me what I must and must not read. And anyway, don't you want to know what 6 million people have dropping onto their doormat every morning? You know, people read this. I want to read it. I want to know what they're thinking.
You are a reader. I can see that. And you're a writer as well.
Yeah, I wrote the book, yes.
Well, it's called
A Dysfunctional Success.
And is that the story of your life?
Yeah, it's my autobiography. Unfortunately, they won't, the publishers can't seem to get anything going to get it published over here.
Well, you are doing gigs, though. I mean, it's not as if you're just sort of visiting here with your girlfriend. You go play.
I've been taking it on, yeah. I did a residency at the Knitting Factory in New York.
Cool.
Which I've just finished, so you can't go and see me there.
Right.
I played at the South by Southwest Festival, and I did Maxwell's in Hoboken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good place.
Will you be coming back to East over the summer, let's say, or late spring?
Maybe I'll come back and do some shows in June, and then again in the fall.
And are people receptive to the new material, or do they expect, like, you know, Reconnaissery?
Because there's a whole load. Well, you know, I went underground from 82 when I left Stiff. Like, I was just, or 81, I think it may have been. It took some time. I made my last record for them in 1980, and it took some time to extricate myself from the label.
Right.
And I went underground. I had a band with two members of Ian Dury's old band, the Blockheads.
Right.
And that's, we did this album for Go Disc. And then after that, I was in a band in the Medway, based in the Medway in Kent, in England, a band called the Lembrite Combo, and we made two albums that are very, in England, we got quite successful. On a smaller level. We used to play in clubs rather than big university halls and, like, town halls and things like that. We played in clubs.
But you can make a living doing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we almost did.
Almost.
And then I moved. At the end of the 80s, I mean, I'd given up drinking in 85, and eventually that got traumatic. I don't think I did it the right way. I stopped going to AA, and I had a nervous breakdown.
How do you know when you have a nervous breakdown?
I think it becomes apparent to other people first, because you start acting a bit strange. I mean, when you start shouting at passers-by and stuff like that, it starts to become more obvious, and it becomes more and more obvious as your life falls to pieces.
Wow. And you know you're sort of over it when...
When
the medication kicks in? No.
Actually, I did have to go to hospital, but I did the sensible thing, which was, by accident, I managed to admit myself to hospital before I was sectioned, which meant that I didn't have to have the medication. I refused all medication, and I got better a lot quicker, I think, than if I'd had medication.
And if you had been forced to go there, they could have given you...
They would have given me everything and put me under, and I would have ended up, like, in the system. And once you're in that system, it's very hard to get out of it, I think. And a lot of people that are...
Any people from the old days of your...
Did I meet anybody I knew?
Not necessarily famous, but yeah.
Well, I know that Viv Stanshaw used to go to the same hospital as me when he, on occasions, who, of course, played with Neil Innes in Bonzo Dog Band. Yes, there was a member of one of Ian Dury's bands who used to pop in and out of there on a regular basis, apparently, but I never met him while I was in there. I didn't actually meet anyone I knew while I was in there.
When, in the old days, I mean, you certainly said you envied Elvis Costello, because he was basically like a song machine.
I didn't envy him at all, actually.
But you were...
I wondered how he did it. I mean, I found it quite impressive that he just could...
But you were penning a lot of stuff then, too. I mean, you know, you had a double album, and that happened very... You were pretty prolific, and I'm kind of wondering if...
I didn't think I was. I mean, like, they used to tell me off for everything at Stiff. You know, that was part of the... They always used to tell me I wasn't successful. Dave Robinson said I was his Achilles heel. He could have a hit with anything, but he couldn't have a hit with me. And I thought, well, I don't want to have a hit record. I figured something out. Well, like, if you become a one-hit wonder and you have a hit record, like a big hit record, that's you. And that can be a choice. I mean, I know Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky. Right. Apparently, that's his set. He plays it for 45 minutes and then comes back on and does it again for the encore.
That's brilliant, though. Yeah.
But that's the kind of groove that you could do that. He tried playing his other stuff, but no one really wanted to know. They just wanted to hear Spirit in the Sky. And I figure that's someone who's made it work for them.
What if you had to be the one who had to tease Reconnaissery out to 45 minutes or Semaphore Signals?
Yeah,
or
those. The whole wide world would be it, I suppose. Or over here, it might be Take the Cash.
Take it, right. Actually, but you see, you wouldn't have been a one-hit one. You would have been like a 4, 5, or 7-hit wonder.
Yeah, but they were never big chart hits, and that was what was wanted. That's what they wanted in England. They wanted to have a chart hit. And I don't think my heart was in it, really. I thought it was a joke, chart hits. I mean, you know, you watch Top of the Pops and it'd be the Police and bands like that. Who wants to be on a show with people like that?
Is your songwriting different, though, now? Or how is it, or is your process different?
I don't know, because I've never actually figured out how you do it. I wish I could, actually. I'd write more stuff if I did. I have to be under some kind of pressure to make another record. I have to have a reason to do it. I can't just do it because that's what I do. Because I also had this kind of crisis about it at the end of the 90s, where I'd think, it's like pollution, all these people writing these disgusting songs, and they write songs about relationships and stuff, and they say, then you see all these singer-songwriters, and like some of the gigs that I was doing around that time, I've watched these singer-songwriter people that do the support opening acts, and they go, this is another song about a relationship, and you go, oh no, I don't want to know about that.
Unless it's a relationship between them, their goat, and their washing machine, then it gets kind of...
Now that's more like it, yeah. But all these... I mean, people have a strange concept of songs, you know. I mean, if I told someone, I was telling you about the Coney Island trip to Coney Island and, like, going on the Big Dipper and that, and, like, someone might say, you could write a song, there's a song in that, and I think, what, a song about going on, you know, people have this concept that they're about this in very bland terms, very black and white, two-dimensional terms, but they're not. It's not quite like that.
Talking with Reckless Eric here in the neighborhood on Dave's Gone By, and just having this marvelous conversation. And then just want to sidetrack for a moment before we forget that he's got an album out, aside from the book that's published in England. He's got an album that's available here. And
just about available here, but...
Southern Domestic, yeah.
Yeah, so Southern Domestic is my own label, and we're licensing it over here. But it is available on import, at least.
All right, and again, also through your website?
It's on all the mail order outlets have got it. But this is part of what I've been saying about, like, that's my first album for 5 years. Because, like, I did have this crisis about how do you carry on, writing songs in the face of more and more and more of the same stuff.
Right.
So how do I move forward?
And what was your answer to that? As you said, was it the techno thing, or was it just ignoring everything?
Ignore everything. Like mix up techno with songwriting, with, like, folk music, with free jazz, with bubblegum, with, like, whatever you want to do. And I figured by the time I made that, nobody wants to know. Nobody is sort of, like, battering my door down saying, where's your new album? There's a handful of people who want to know. And I figured, well, it would be a shame if I alienated them, but it wouldn't be the end of the world because, you know, there's not a million people who are waiting for a new album. So it's not the... So...
Well, but maybe 250,000. Possibly.
I wish there were.
All right, well, you know, a quarter of a quarter million. But some of the songs on here include Bungalow High and Lady Power, Magnificent Party, and what's the one that's kind of getting some attention?
The one that everyone likes is 33s and 45s, which is, like, it's kind of misunderstood, really. They say that it's the breakup of a relationship.
Uh-oh, there's that relationship word. Yeah.
Yeah, they say, you know, all that kind of thing documented in records. I don't know, they say all kinds of rubbish about it, but it's just like, you always, if you're a musician, or if you're into music, like most of the people I know are really into music, so the record collectors, I just know loads of nerdy records.
Really. Hello,
like,
yes.
Anything that happens to you, like, I think you tend to sort of, like, this is your reference is always your record collection. I can document anything that happened in my life. I can come back to it. I can go, now what record was out? What was I playing? What was I listening to at the time? And that album just came out. I remember, you know, because
yes.
I was
Yeah, I mean, I'm a geeky record collector and CD collector now.
And if you look at the records and listen to the records, you can remember exactly where you are, where you were at that time.
Well, hopefully folks will go out and buy the new Reckless Eric album. It's called Bungalow High, and they'll maybe remember 10 or 20 or 30 years from now where they were or what they were doing or where America was like when the song 33 and 45, was that a good segue or what, came out.
It was almost slick, but I couldn't quite follow it. But I've screwed it up now.
And by the way, I should mention that the version on the CD is about 7.5 minutes long and also has some naughty bits in it that we can't play. So I'm going to play a radio edit of it, but if you want to hear the whole thing, you're going to get the CD.
Yeah, buy the CD. And it was called an LP again.
I wish it was a size one. Remember the cool covers?
Yeah. Do I remember them? I still have them, you know. Yeah. Just that you can't release them now because apparently no one wants them except all the people I know.
And the audiophiles, you know, the big bands will still put out, like a Bob Dylan or a U2 will put out an LP in a very limited run because they can, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But, and they sit in the record shops for years.
Right.
Like getting the corners getting destroyed, you know, because no one wants them.
Right. Do you frequent the radio, the few LP shops that are in the village around here still, and you check them out?
I do, yes, I do spend time, money in record shops. It's disgraceful.
No, I'll be doing that until I'm like 90.
I bought a Staples Singers album on Stax. It was just the greatest hits, but it was on the Stax label. It was an original Stax. I bought the Inflated Tear by Roland Kirk.
Okay.
Bought a copy of that, like vinyl. That was my. That's just the other day.
All right. So you're looking for a certain,
Well, yeah. I mean, like something's come up, and I bought what I think is possibly a bootleg of King Tubby.
I do not know. King Tubby. Yeah.
Right. Studio One, Jamaican.
Oh,
reggae,
cool.
Top dub. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, if people knew what I was into, they'd be appalled.
Well, let's get into 33s and 45s.
Yeah, this is Reckless Eric on Dave's Gone By. I think you steer a fine line between banality and sort of obscure, pretentious poetry.
My God, that's this show. No.
But I also thought that there's so many newer songwriters who just work with, especially bad songwriters who work with verses and choruses, and they work with chord patterns, and they all do the same thing, and I'm thinking, this is just pollution. I wish there was another way of making music. And then a friend of mine who's a DJ in England said, the trouble with songwriting is that it gets in the way of making music.
Hmm.
And I know exactly what. So, and I got into all the dance music thing in England.
Because, maybe because it's a group effort, because it's a band, or?
After rave and everything, I got into DJ stuff. Like, like techno,
as
you call it over here. Because it's just immediate. Those people, they go into the studio with nothing and they say, right, we're going to make a record. And they make it. And they make it happen in there. And the music is the medium.
Hmm.
Where this whole idea of writing a collection of songs and then getting some people together to play them and teaching them all how to play them in some crummy rehearsal room and then booking a studio and playing the songs in there as best as you possibly can and then putting that out as an album doesn't really appeal to me. I think it's boring.
Wow.
And you get groups like...
Well, that's the history of...
Do you have Travis?
I rather like Travis, but okay, yes, they've had a couple of hits over here.
Although people talk about songs being well-crafted.
Yeah.
I don't want to know about well-crafted. I mean, like, I want to know about something that will fall apart in your hands. I want to know about cheap rubbish. I want to know about anything but well-crafted. People get to a certain age. They get to over the age of 35, and then they get a better job, and then they start furnishing their homes with well-made furniture. You know, they'll get a piece of, they'll get a wooden armchair kind of thing, a set of dining chairs, and say they're well-crafted. What do I want well-crafted songs for? I don't want to know about that. I want something that's tricky and devious and insulting and rancid.
Much
that more,
is this show,
yeah. Much, as the, oh, great, it's not a well-crafted show.
Yeah.
Now, that's much more fun to me.
Huh. Well, we're talking to the tricky and devious and occasionally rancid, reckless Eric. Dave's gone by. We do have to kind of wrap this up, but who published the book in England, by the way, in case people can get it, like, on Amazon or something?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it through my website as well, which, of course, is www.recklesseric.com.
Reckless with a W, recklesseric.com. And if you're looking for the author of the book, it's Eric Goulden, G-O-U-L-D-E-N.
Yeah. And it's called A Dysfunctional Success.
I guess the closing question would then be, in writing the book, was there any kind of cathartic moment or something that you learned about yourself in the telling of yourself?
No, I think I've got that pretty well sorted out because I've been sober for a long time. But I did have this thing about it must be 100% honest.
And is it, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I know my sister's hardly speaking to me because I told the world about her Rolling Stones poster. She just, she was about 10 at the time. She was a little bit older than me, and she labelled them up. She couldn't remember their names, so she labelled them on this Rolling Stones Fabulous 2008 poster, Blondie, Curly, Toothy, Charlie, and the other one.
Maybe the other one would have been a little upset.
Blondie, I think, was Brian Jones. Toothy was
Cliff Richards. Well, that would work, yeah.
Cliff Richard.
Mouthy, I guess, would be,
Blondie, Curly, Toothy. Curly, I can't remember who Curly was now. Bill Wyman. Blondie, Curly, Toothy, Charlie. No, the other one was probably...
What would Mick have been called? Probably Lippy or something? Or
I think he was actually Toothy, come to think of it, because he was grinning, because he was the lead singer.
Right, and he had that goat sort of thing going on, probably, yeah. So this is the worst thing she's holding you against?
Yeah, well, I said that about 9 or 10 at the time, and she was about 11 or whatever, and I said in the book I was beginning to understand that she'd somehow missed the point. she's very angry about that. But I say, well, why I became a rock and roll star and you became a chartered accountant.
Well, we are here with rock and roll star, legitimately.
I'm not really a rock and roll star. I was a rock and roll star for about 2 minutes in 1979.
All right, semi-legend, twice removed, Reckless Eric. And I thank you so much for joining us in the neighborhood.
Thank you.